This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:05 in the evening, which means it is time for our monthly Movers and Shakers Town Hall, where we get politicians, ministers, civil society members to come in. And then basically what we do is we hand the reins over to you to ask your questions. Today we have Azhar Harun, or Ad Harun, with us in the studio. He is, of course, the chairman of the Election Commission and also the first chairman not from the civil service. Before we get to our questions, if you have any questions about voting, elections, the electoral process, the EC, call us 7733 2900. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Art, welcome to the show.
Thank you, BFM, for having me here. Hello, Malaysian.
So we wanted to start with this, right? So since becoming the chairman, you've observed three by-elections have gone by so far. What have your observations been? What have you learned from them?
Well, I learned that the secretariat that I inherit, they are pretty efficient and pretty hardworking people. They know what to do. And that is very helpful to me. And another one that I learned is that, well, this just further cemented whatever perception I have before regarding our political parties and regarding our election process. It's a battleground. So, our political parties, our candidates, they regard election as somewhat a battle or a war, you know. And we're trying to lessen that kind of practice because, you know, it's not good. It become very fiery and people get worked out quite easily during election campaign period.
And on that note, right, so based on Bursi's observations, Pakatan committed the highest number of electoral offences in Semenye, 21, and Barisan 13 there. In Cameron Highlands, Barisan committed 14 and Pakatan 5. So Bursi's chairperson said, despite efforts by Bursi and EC, there are still political parties breaking the law. Why do you think they're still breaking the laws?
Well, because I think they're used to it. and also because prior to this, nobody spend any time talking about Election Offences and Election Offences Act. I'm not defending Pakatan, but Pakatan seem to have higher number of offences because they are the government. And being the government, there are offences which they could commit, which the opposition cannot commit.
Right.
And that is the misuse of government assets, misuse of ministerial time, and government activities which are used to bait voters and vote. So these three offences, or these three transgression of ethics, cannot be committed by the opposition. Yeah. So that's why they seem to have higher numbers of offences, according to Bursi. Yeah.
Again, if you have any questions today about the electoral process, about voting, anything at all, call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. We have got Taufik on the line. Taufik, good evening. You have a question.
Yeah, I want to ask, has the EC ever... Okay, Malaysia's voting system is based on the first past the post, which is similar to the UK and the US. However, as we all know, this voting system is a bit flawed. So has the EC ever considered trying to reform the voting system, maybe go for something that is like where you can vote for the candidate based on rank, like you rank each candidate?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Actually, the system practiced by us is, of course, first past the post. And we are seeing in the European Union countries are moving towards more proportionate representative. And actually, this matter is being looked into, but not by SPR. It is being looked by the Electoral Reform Committee, headed by Tan Sri Rashid. I believe they are looking at it seriously. And I think they'll be looking at the model practiced by Germany and some other European countries. Yes, that is being looked into.
And we also have a question here from G. Nathan saying, I'm referring to the Rantau by-election. Honestly, do you think the election officers who blocked Dr. Seatrum acted within their jurisdiction or did this more on, and I'm quoting here, shock sendiri? That's question one. Question two, I feel the candidate concerned should be compensated for wrongful treatment. And I feel that, you know, perhaps you need to exhibit a tougher stance in carrying out your duties. And that came through from G. Navin.
Yeah, of course, the Rantau officers, I think, who were involved in that event had been adjudicated by the court, and the court had said that it was a transgression of electoral process law, and the court had therefore determined that the by-election was void and ordered a new by-election. There is no question of compensation under the law. In any other Commonwealth country as well, there is no question of compensation. They have the right to partake in a new by-election. And yeah, we have issued a writ of election, which is going to take place on the 30th is the nomination day, 30th March, and on the 13th is the polling day. They could always take part again as a candidate. Yeah. Whether I could be more...
A tougher stance was tougher the actual stance. Phrase, yeah.
Well, I think I've been tough enough. I have made clear of what could and what could not be done by political parties. Within the confine of the powers that I have, I think I have exercised everything that I could. But of course, if the people think more power should be given to the EC, I wouldn't say I welcome that, but if it is given, then we will execute that powers in accordance with the law that is going to be passed for that purpose. Yeah, and I think in that respect, the ERC is also looking into the issue of whether the Election Commission should be given the power to investigate, the power to prosecute, and also the power to impose fines summarily. Against offenders. So that is being looked into, yes.
Okay, so we have another question here, I guess two questions from Zaidi and Mark, essentially about e-voting, because at the moment, for example, Zaidi finds it quite burdensome and a waste of time and energy. Is that something we're looking to?
We are, actually. The e-voting, there are two parts to e-voting. I mean, two methods of e-voting. One is internet voting, where you don't have to go to any polling station. You just probably download the app and vote for whoever you like. That's internet voting. And then there's another voting, but this one you still have to go to the polling station, but instead of using the manual ballot paper, you use a machine. So they call the machine electronic voting machine. So we're looking at both. Right now, of course, people are talking about blockchain technology, you know, to ensure that there is no hacking or there's no changes. I mean, there's no changes to the data. So we are engaging experts who are pro blockchain and also experts who are against blockchain. We are not inclined for internet voting, I think, at the moment. But we're looking at the EVM, electronic voting machine, deeper. At this juncture. Yeah.
And just to pick up on Zaidi's point about physical voting being burdensome, I think for many people, I suppose, who have cast their votes, there is a memory of, you know, lining up, waiting, trying to game the system by figuring out the right time to go. yeah. You know, would this be an improvement on that kind of experience if we put the machines in place? Potentially, I guess.
I like the word that you use, experience. So I think that's part of the fun, isn't it? I mean, you know. I think even in Australia, a modern country where their election commission is so powerful and so efficient, they are still using the normal manual ballot paper. And in fact, if you look at their ballot paper, it's much, much more complicated than ours, you know. Their ballot paper is divided into two, where you can vote for the party on one side, on one part of the ballot paper, and you can vote for the candidate on the other part of the ballot paper. It's very, very complicated process. You know, in the UK, they're still using ballot paper. And I have engaged with people from the United States who actually told me, don't use the machine, please, you know. So, but on our part, of course, we would like to make the balloting process more efficient, right now the bottleneck is where the voter walk into the polling area,
right,
and to check their name whether they're on electoral roll or not. I have personally timed, they took between 40 to 58 seconds doing that. Yeah, so I would like to do that electronically and reduce that. Okay, so they spend 40 to 58 seconds there, and then they move to dip their finger into the ink and take a ballot paper, and then they will go and do the balloting. So all together, they took about 1 minute 30 seconds to 1 minute 58 seconds, or 2 minutes rather. Okay, so if the first step where the bottleneck is could be shortened, I think it would be more efficient.
We're speaking today, of course, with the chairman of the Election Commission, Art Harun. If you've got any questions, call us 7733 2900. The floor is yours. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back. There have been more questions that have come through on WhatsApp, and we'll come back to answer those right after this. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. In the studio with us for our monthly Mover and Shaker Town Hall is Art Harun, the chairman of the Election Commission. And we are taking your questions on anything really that you would like to ask. You can call 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. And a question that has come through very strongly and from several listeners actually is about to be asked, I believe, by Ravi, who we have on the line. Ravi, good evening. Your question?
Hi. My question is, there are some polling stations or some areas where there are 400,000 voters and there are some with 20,000 voters. Is there any plans to realignate these areas? And what is the procedure that's needed to do that?
Yeah.
Ravi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Ravi. I think this is a concern shared by many, many Malaysians.
Yes.
This is a result of the last redelineation, which was unfortunately approved by our parliament in March last year. And that redelineation exercise was then formalized and used during GE14. Now, if we look at the result of that redelineation exercise, there are some constituencies with 20,000, 30,000 voters and who vote for one a member of parliament. And there are other constituencies with only 5,000 or 8,000 voters who also vote for one a member of parliament. Now, that, I think, is a transgression of our democratic process, to be quite frank, and to say it bluntly. It is a transgression and it makes a mockery of one voter, one vote policy. Having said so, unfortunately, under the federal constitution, the redelineation exercise can only be carried out once in every 8 years. So we start with that. Yeah. So any exercise for redelineation which I may want to carry out now is arguably and quite clearly unconstitutional.
Right.
Yeah. The only exception to that rule is that if our parliament and if the state legislative assembly of all the other states pass a resolution to change the number of seats in their respective state or to change the parliamentary seats, then it can trigger that exercise all over again. So as we all may know, to amend the constitution, whether at state level or the federal constitution, you need 2/3 majority. Yeah. So whether that is achievable is left to be seen. We do not know whether that can be achieved. On my side, what I've done is I'll be looking at the redelineation exercise which was approved last year. We will analyze it in depth to see the economic impact, to see the demographic impact, the social impact, and even the racial impact. And we will then make conclusion as to whether the redelineation exercise was proper or not. and we will make proposal for future re-donation exercise. So that is probably the best that I could do, unless I find some legal way to do the exercise all over again, despite the 8-year rule. Who knows? I might be able to come up with something.
Yeah. Mike actually follows up to say, you know, what steps can be put in place to avoid any future gerrymandering by ruling parties? Although listening to this and hearing that sort of 8-year gap that is required, I guess it is still a concern because the memory, I suppose, of what happened is very fresh for many.
Yeah. You see, the problem with man-made law is that man can change the law, right? So, okay. Frankly, we are making proposal to imbue the federal constitution with the one man, one vote policy and spell it out clearly in the constitution. Again, to do that, we need 2/3 majority. And God willing, if we are successful at doing that, of course, then that will be the law for future re-donation exercise. But as I said, man-made law could always be changed. So we could change to imbue that principle in the federal constitution, and another government come in later, they could change as well if they have 2/3 majority. So let's hope for the best.
So we have a text here from Raja which says that parties have become racial and frantic at times. So I think he's drawing reference to the incidents during the recent by-elections. We saw a lot of hate speech and speeches that threatened voters. Mm. You know, Pakatan, for example, allegedly threatening Tok Batins in Cameron Highlands. Mohammad Hassan of UMNO with his penumpang comments against the non-Malays. So yeah. What are the provisions of laws with regards to hate speech and speeches that threaten voters?
I'm quite interested to talk about this, really, because not many people know. There are actually provisions in the Election Offences Act which are aimed specifically at this kind of offences. First of all, it's Section 4, Capital A of the Election Offences Act. We say that any person who directly or indirectly make any statement with a view or with a tendency to promote feeling of ill will, discontent, they commit an offence, yeah? And this offence is punishable by imprisonment for a term of not exceeding 5 years and a fine of not exceeding 10,000 ringgit. Yeah. More importantly is another section, which is Section 9 of the Election Offences Act, which is concerned with what is termed as undue influence. Yeah. This is a section which criminalise any speeches or any act which threaten the voters not to vote for someone or to vote for someone. So if you threaten them with physical harm, with economic harm, so it come under undue influence. But most importantly about Section 9 is a subsection 2 to subsection 9, which not many people talk about. And I have started talking about this during Cameron Highland by-election and during Semenyih. And now I would like to talk about it more specifically. Section 2 is very interesting. It says, a person shall be deemed to interfere with the free exercise of the electoral right of a person within the meaning of this section who induces or attempt to induce such person to believe that he or any person in whom he is interested will become or will be rendered an object of divine displeasure or spiritual censure. Yeah. So, if I go around and say, if you don't vote for me, you go to hell, that is
literally
an offence.
Yeah.
Under Section 9, Subsection 2. So, I really, really hope that all candidates, all political party, please take heed that Section 9, Subsection 2 specifically say and prohibit them from going around to decree divine displeasure or spiritual censure if the voters don't vote for them or if the voters vote for their opponent.
Yeah. Considering the fact that traditionally election spaces and the communication within campaigning periods tends to be very, very fraught, this is not the first time we've seen it. It's always the case. Yeah. Do you think that we are headed, are we anywhere close to reaching a space where we can be more civil in terms of how campaigning occurs? Or is it the very nature of election campaigning that it will always be a little bit heated?
Well, it is the very nature Well, you know, it will become natural if you don't do anything to stop that practice, right? Mm. Of course, I mean, we can see in France, the right wing will say all sort of things. And even in Australia, you know, we see the right wingers, the extreme right wingers will see all sort of things. Because new patriotism and new nationalism is an election bait. Right, everybody would jump onto the bandwagon. Yeah, even some people would even create a war to win election. We have seen that, you know. But of course, we cannot stop and accept that kind of practice. We have to do something, you know. And it doesn't matter whether it's getting worse or whether it has been practiced all this while and nobody say anything. But we have to do something to stop it. Because it is very divisive, and very destructive to me. And in fact, I think all right-thinking Malaysians will agree with that.
We're speaking today with Azhar Harun, Chairman of the Election Commission. If you've got any questions at all about the electoral process, about the EC, about elections, call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. To everybody who has already been doing that, we see your questions and we will get to them right after the 6:30 news. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Become fabulous millionaires. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:36. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Calvin. Specifically, it is our monthly Movers and Shakers Town Hall. With us today is Azhar Harun, Chairman of the Election Commission, here to answer any of your burning questions about anything to do with elections, really. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we're just going to be running through a lot of questions that we've been receiving on both WhatsApp and Twitter. First up, Kelvin says, I want to know why Malaysian inmates cannot vote.
Oh, well, qualification to vote is dealt with in the Federal Constitution, Article 119. And if an inmate is serving a sentence of imprisonment of more than 12 months, then he is actually disqualified from voting. So if he is, for example, if an inmate is serving a sentence of 13 months imprisonment and a general election is called while he is serving that sentence, then he is disqualified. But to those people who are serving less than 12 months, they are technically qualified, yes.
So our next question comes from Chufat and Jason. It's about local government elections. So for Chufat's point, he says the administration of cities must be answerable to the rate and taxpayers because of their rather large budgets. What does it take for it to be reinstituted?
Well, that will have to be a policy decision made by the members of parliament in the parliament. The Election Commission is taking a neutral stand. We are just concerned with the operational side of election. So if the parliament decides that there should be, or if the cabinet decides there should be local government election, then so be it. Then if we are required to do so, then we will, at operation level, we will carry that task. Yeah.
Amar wants to know, are the army and police forced to vote for the government of the day? If not, can the EC openly declare it?
No, they're not forced, at least under my watch, they're not forced. If you look in Semenya recently, the result from the Undi Awal, the early voting, clearly was in favour of the opposition and not in favour of the government. Yeah, so there is no force going on.
So we have a question here from Dinesh about campaigning. Currently, candidates are given 2 weeks to campaign, but that time frame is not enough for the voters to get to know their candidates properly. So two questions here. Should the campaigning period be increased to, say, maybe a month or even more? And is it possible to make debates between candidates mandatory so that voters can really know the essence and intellectual fitness of the candidates before casting their votes?
Interesting. Okay, I think prior to my appointment, there were one or two by-election where the campaign period was 21 days. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The political parties complained that it's too long. So when I came in Port Dickson, Cameron Highland, Semenye and Rantau, we decided 14 days. would be just a reasonable time to campaign for a by-election. Of course, for a general election, the general thinking that we have now is probably 21 days would be a nice, reasonable period. But that has not been cast in stone. We are still talking about that. Yeah.
And when it comes to, I suppose, making candidates hold debates, is that something that you think would be put in place soon?
Mm. Well, I mean, we can't impose, that kind of condition on all candidates.
Sure.
In Cameron Highland, I think Bersih, through their own initiative, organised a debate. But of course, one candidate refused to come. And in Semenyih also, that did not happen. There is no requirement under the law for a debate to go on between election candidates. If we would like to compel them, then there must be a legal compulsion. Otherwise, forget about it. Nobody is going to come to debate. But having said so, we're looking at the presidential debate in Indonesia, a 3 or 4 rounds of debates with a different focus in each round of the debate. I think it's very interesting. And if you ask me personally, I would love to have a look at candidates, especially for the higher office, to actually pit their skill and so that people will know what their manifestos are, what their promises are, and what their weaknesses and strengths are. That would be a good initiative, I think.
We have a question on Twitter from Tasnim who says, following the Undi Rosak campaign in GE14, are there any plans to put a third option on the ballot for those who don't want to vote for any of the political parties or candidates? None of the above, or NOTA for short, also known as against all, or a scratch vote?
Okay, I mean, I think this come from a tweet that I made some time ago. In India, the Supreme Court had actually ordered the Indian Election Commission to actually put a third option on the ballot paper, i.e. none of the above. And surprisingly, there were instances where the votes for none of the above had actually gained the most number of votes. So, on the face of it, the right to vote should come with the right not to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why we don't compel people to go to vote. I mean, in Australia, voting is mandatory. Those who do not come out to vote are subject to a fine, I think, of $100 Australian or $200 Australian. So to me, if you don't want to vote, you just don't come to vote. So, it's the same with none of the above. Right.
I suppose the issue there is that none of the above is a way to practice the right to vote while also signifying displeasure with the current state of affairs. I mean, that tends to be how it's registered.
And I guess the message is a lot stronger, right? If you don't vote for reasons of, if you don't go to the voting station, for example, that could be multiple reasons. Maybe you just couldn't make it. Maybe you just chose not to. But if you do the no vote option through the ballot paper, it sends a stronger message that none of you, I don't like any of you, right?
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. But I think if you don't vote, you just don't vote. I don't have to suffer more cost to print another column on the ballot paper and make the ballot paper more complicated. You must also remember, the ballot paper, the voters here, a large number of them are rural area. And I have seen in Cameron Highland where there are old people who do not actually know how to vote. So can you imagine if I put none of the above in addition to all the other candidates? I think it will complicate matters. We have to take that into consideration as well.
So we have a question here from CY who says that, is there a reason why race identification of voters is still required? And do you think doing away with it will help to minimise the racial-related speeches and promises?
Well, I mean, we have been talking about this for a long time, whether, race should be included on even on our identity card. And now, of course, we have to confront the question of whether race should be done away from the electoral roll altogether. We will need to actually think about this in depth and see why we need the race there, and if it is needed at all. Of course, we will look at it in the reform agenda that we're going to that we are embarking on.
There is also a push, I think, from a few listeners about making all Malaysians above 21, you know, automatic voters. So to just automatically register. Mm. Is that something that we're looking into?
Yes, we are. Both the Election Commission, the SPR, and the Electoral Reform Committee are looking into it. We have engaged on this issue recently. And I think a proposal will be at hand soon. But it is not that simple because, you know, the qualification to vote under Article 119, as I stated just now, is not only citizenship. Yeah. So once you attain the age of 21, the JPN, Jabatan Pendaftaran Negara, would then link to my system and say, okay, this is an eligible voter, so let's vote it. Let's register him automatically. That is simple. If the qualification to vote is just that, but the qualification vote, the criteria to vote, to qualify to vote, there are other criteria, you know. You cannot serve. You mustn't be serving a sentence in the prison for more than 12 months at that moment, for example. So then the system will have to also be linked to the prison department, for example. So, yeah, we need to synchronize between all the authorities that are involved before that could be implemented. But yes, we're considering that seriously.
We're speaking today with Art Haran, the chairman of the Election Commission. If you've any questions for him, call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with more of your questions right after this. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin, and live in the studio with us today, Azhar Harun, the chairman of the Election Commission, here to answer your questions. You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. So we spoke about this last week, and we also just had a question come in from Joanne on the same matter. There's been a suggestion from the Electoral Reforms Committee for people to vote where they live instead of where they come from. Joanne wants to know, can voting constituencies be changed following the MyCard address? How would something like this work?
Yeah, I mean, I've been talking about this actually. The system that we practice now is domicile-based. I call it domicile-based because although we may be residing somewhere else and our identity card reflects that residential address, we could still go back home to our kampung to vote. And because we regard that kampung as our domicile. And, you know, as we know, domicile don't change, but residential may change, right? So that is the system that is enshrined in our federal constitution, yes? So if I had registered myself at the time I was eligible to vote, I have registered in Kedah, for example, and then later I migrate to Kuala Lumpur and I change my address, I could still go back to Kedah to vote. And there is no law that would compel me to change my constituency to Kuala Lumpur unless I voluntarily do so. So because of that, every general election, we see people from Kelantan, for example. Yeah, there are thousands of them in Kuala Lumpur, and then they will go back to vote in Kelantan, although they are residing in Kuala Lumpur. So now, of course, there are arguments saying that, look, if you stay in PJ, for example, Section 17, you are enjoying Section 17 facilities. Yeah, utilities, facilities, and you are paying your taxes in Section 17. And you are being served by a member of parliament in that constituency. Why do you then go back to Kota Baru to vote when you do not have anything to do with Kota Baru? The member of parliament there do not serve you. You may not even know him. You do not even know his performance there because all the while, the 5 years, you are in Section 17. So that's an argument to change the system.
Mm-hmm.
You have to vote where you live. So those arguments are quite cogent. It's a very fair argument, really. And of course, you can't really find any argument to counter that argument. Yes. But having said so, that system has been practiced since we achieved independence. And the people who are pro this domicile-based voting system are saying that, look, I have this close affinity to my kampung. You know, even if I die, I would like to be buried there. I still care of what happened there and what is going to happen there. And because of that, I would like to vote there so that my representative, the representative who are going to represent my kampung, is elected by me, although I may live somewhere else, okay? Because that is my domicile. So, yeah, there are pros and cons.
Would it also end up swelling the numbers of yes. urban voters, for example?
Sure. Yeah. For sure. If we change that system to make it more residential, then Selangor and Kuala Lumpur will have the most number of seats.
Yes, exactly.
If we are talking about the one vote, one voter, one vote policy at its best, then Kuala Lumpur and Selangor will have probably the most number of seats. And, you know, Sarawak and Sabah may reduce the number of seats because a lot of them are in Kuala Lumpur, in Johor Bahru, in Singapore. And, yeah. And how do we treat people who are abroad? That's another thing.
Mm.
You know, they're abroad. They're not even in Malaysia. So if you are using that argument against the domicile-based voters, a voting system, then those people who are abroad can't vote because they are nowhere within Malaysia. So that would be unfair as well. So yeah, we have to look it to look at this proposal deeper, more in depth. We will have to study the ramification and consequences of changing that system before we could decide on what to do next.
And on that note about East Malaysian voters, we do have a question here from Ms. Kumar, who says that mm-hmm. you know, voting is very much more difficult for them given their geographic circumstances. Yeah. Are there plans to make it easier in the future for them?
Of course, we're looking at making vote. Making the vote processes easier. But you know, we have to bear in mind the geography of the state involved. You know, the constituency and the you know how rural the area is and whatever. So, as much as we would like to make the voting experience easier for everyone, there are constraints that, you know, is a geographical, natural constraint that we have to deal with. Even in Cameron Highland, there are rivers that we have to cross. You know, there are places with no broadband, no telecommunication. We have to use a computer. I mean, we have to use helicopters. We have to use heavy duty 4-wheel drive vehicle. And in Sabah and Sarawak, even more so. So, but you know, India had just announced their general election. Part of their electoral workforce is thousands of donkeys, because you know they need the donkeys to carry the ballot paper to the Himalayas to really really rural area. So that's a constraint that every election commission had to live with, and that's democracy.
So our next question is about bringing down the voting age to 18. That's something the government's been championing, and it comes from Wendy and Trevor. So they're both afraid about the level of maturities and how impressionable these 18 to 20-year-old voters are. Mm. What are your thoughts on lowering the voting age?
Well, there are 40-year-olds who are not yet adult. So, you know, there are pros and cons. But, you know, due to the, I think in 2019, due to the standard of education that all of us generally are enjoying nowadays, you know, the exposure that we have via broadbands and via the internet, I think the level of thinking, the level of education have really increased as compared to my time, 1969, standard one, you know. And I think the age of 18 is a ripe age to allow voting. Most of the countries have gone even down to 17. And strangely, Lebanon, Singapore, and Malaysia are still at 21, even Singapore. In Indonesia, the voting age is 17, or if you're married. So if you're married at 12, in Indonesia, you can vote. Yeah. So I suppose the rationale is if you could choose your spouse, why can't you choose your member of parliament? So yes, I think 18 is a good age.
We also have a question here from Anne, which is a bit more of a personal one. I've always been an ardent reader of your blogs and your shout outs on Facebook. You were a litigation lawyer all your life with very firm beliefs and opinions on many things. Was it a worthy change of career from being in practice to now being part of the EC? Do you miss practice?
Yes, I miss practice because, you know, I love arguing. So, yeah. it is worthy because, you know, doing something that I think is good for the country, reforming the electoral system, is a worthy cause, and I rather quite enjoy it, actually. Yeah.
So moving forward, I guess, what are the most pressing things the EC is trying to change at the moment? Perhaps give us your top three.
First of all, I think it's the cleaning up of electoral roll. You know, there are 73,000 people who are more than 90 years old, and you know, the oldest age is 150. So we need to clean it up. And then, of course, there are 3.7 million people who are not registered as voters. We are going to launch an online application soon, this year. It is being developed at final stage now. And I think we are going to collaborate with the United Nations to clean up our electoral roll as far as possible. That will be done and is being done now. Then, of course, the second one, I think we need to look really, really seriously at the Election Offences Act. I would love to make the provision clearer and more focused. And I would love to have a look at the implementation, or rather the enforcement side of it. All of us will have to take the Election Offences and transgression of the Election Offences Act more seriously. There ought to be a concerted effort, not only by SPR, but also by the people in general, and by the political parties, as well as the enforcement agencies. So that's the second one. I think the third one, we would like to improve efficiency. I think various initiatives have been introduced since Cameron Highland, and we could see efficiency is being improved. You know, on nomination day, especially in Semenyih, we managed to declare the successful candidate at 10:22 a.m. As opposed to before. You know, sometimes we do it at 12, sometimes we do it at 11:30. And we managed in Cameron Highland as well as Semenyih to even declare the winner, the result of the election, way before the targeted 10 p.m. That night. So we would like to improve the efficiency as far as we can as well.
Art, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
That was Azhar Harun, Chairman of the Election Commission, on this month's Movers and Shakers Town Hall. We'll have more stories for you coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.